This is Roger Molina. I'm delighted to be here at breakfast in a Parisian cafe with Brian Burnham, who's a young geologist. Brian, just tell us quickly about yourself, and I gather you've just finished your PhD.
I did, Roger. I just finished it a week and a few bits ago. I had my Viva, and my PhD was building three-dimensional models of past rivers in Spain.
In Spain. Excellent. Okay, so we'll talk about that. So I'm an astrophysicist, but I'm now working at UT Dallas. We have an earth science research lab where the idea is to get artists and scientists to work together on projects, which could not be done without those collaborations. So one of the things that we talked about at breakfast, we've been talking about, is if I give you $100 million, Brian, what would you do with it? And you started telling me about what's called sequence stratigraphy. So what is sequence stratigraphy and why is it important?
Sequence stratigraphy is it's a way for us to analyze sea level rise and fall by looking at different types of rocks that come to fruition when sea level is low. Different types of rocks are deposited, and then sea level rises again, different types of rocks are deposited. And we were able to recognize that back in the 80s. It became a more formal way of looking at rocks in geology.
So basically, this is a topic that's become crucially important because of climate change. We know that sea levels are going to change. And so the geological record can be used now through sequence stratigraphy to look at past sea level changes.
Absolutely. Absolutely right. Yep.
And if I understand correctly, the idea is as the sea level rises, certain kind of deposits form. As it drops, then the river deposits form, and so you get these alternations of deposits as the sea level goes up and down.
Right. So you can get deposits of stuff from the sea when it's high, and then when it falls again, you get more stuff from the land. So you might see more like tree trunks or something deposited.
And so I guess my idea for breakfast, if I was given $100 million or euros or whatever, is I'm now working, as I mentioned, in the lab of trying to get people from very, very disciplines to work together. Part of that is called transdisciplinary collaboration. And it's really difficult. And part of the problem is all our institutions are organized around the tree of knowledge with departments. And as the tree grows, the branches get further and further apart. And so indeed, the art department and the science department are often not on the same campus and certainly never in the same building. And so I guess I'm interested in the problem of how you enable transdisciplinary collaborations today in ways that maybe not possible 50 years ago. So so that's what I would invest the funding in, is developing those methodologies, but also the organizational networks and structures to enable that kind of work. So maybe a question for you in geology. I think one of the things you told me was that your supervisor was working in something which you call computational geosciences. So what is that?
That is developing software and developing programs that allow geologists to either interpret rocks, which is what I did for my PhD, or maybe try to build time models of what's called isostatic rebound, is when the glaciers melted 12,000 years ago, the ground started to uplift again because of the weight of the glaciers held them down. So when they're not there, the whole ground can rise again.
So I guess computational geosciences is an example of interdisciplinary work, because indeed you need very high-level people in computer science and very high-level people in geology and the geosciences. And indeed your supervisor is one of these bridge people.
Absolutely.
That has that double expertise.
Yeah, and he's a brilliant...
What's his name, by
the way? His name is David Hodgetts at the University of Manchester. I guess kind of the crowning jewel that he's been working on is a software called Virtual Reality Geological Studio, which is what I use to do a lot of my interpretation. And this can take all manners of data from large point cloud data all the way down to tomographic scale of like thin sections of rocks. And it can even model fluid migration of rivers. You can even, and air is fluid as well, so it can theoretically model air, And so this type of software is incredibly useful for geologists that study all sorts of rocks.
So what did you call it? Virtual reality?
Virtual reality geological studio.
Geological studio. So basically that's creating three-dimensional representations, I guess, of geological data.
It allows you to visualize three-dimensional uh-huh. representations.
And navigate through it?
Navigate through it, fly around, interpret it at a very, very high resolution and scale. So whatever you collect your data at and then put it into the software. So an example would be my PhD. I can look at 20-centimeter scale rocks in a four three-dimensional 2-square-kilometer area, as opposed to people who only look at maybe every 100 meters, they might have a bit of data input. But because I'm able to put this data into Virtual Reality Geological Studio, I can then fly around this 2-square-kilometer area and look at the relationships from one end of it, fly 2 kilometer away to the other bit, and then I can start to look at relationships.
And so actually one of the things we chatted about earlier at breakfast was that in fact it's amazingly helpful when you're working with data to actually shift it and represent it in different kinds of ways. And you talked about the importance of sketching and drawing for people working in the geosciences. So talk a little bit about this translation process between the data and ways of representing it.
Well, geology is inherently a four-dimensional area of study because you have X, Y, Z directions, but time, if time is indeed the fourth dimension, affects geological deposits over time. So if we're talking about sea level rise and fall, that's over time scales that are very large, but it's still a time scale. And so it's important for us to recognize the characteristics that we can see in the rocks and relate that back to some sort of time scale. So with my study, I looked at rivers, and so rivers evolve over time and they make certain deposits behind based on how large a river was, how small it was, how turbulent it was. And so by putting this data into larger three-dimensional visualization context, you can start to backstrip it and start to look at this fourth-dimensional process that governs what we see in the outcrops.
Very good. So I think maybe we're going to subtitle our podcast Virtual Reality Geological Studio, because indeed what's sort of interesting there is the terminology uses the term studio, which obviously comes about out of the art and design culture.
Absolutely.
But applies that concept in a physical science. And I guess the connection I was going to make, the way I originally met you is when I first started teaching at the University of Texas at Dallas. You were a young geosciences master's student at the time, I guess. But you were taking courses in the School of Art and Technology. So how come you as a young geoscience student felt the need to take art and technology courses?
Because in geology, it's critically important to visualize the processes that govern what rocks are left behind, whether it's a river or whether it's the sea level rise and fall, whatever the process is, wind-driven process. It's very important to visualize that when you're in the field or visualize it in the laboratory, because you easily forget what you've seen in the field. But if you can sketch it properly in your notebook, or if you can collect it with LiDAR data and then take it back and visualize it, you can revisit these sites over and over and over again and come up with new interpretations. I could go back to my field area in 10 years from now, relook at the data when some new shift in the geological sciences has happened, and I can come up with a whole new idea for it, possibly.
So, and you felt that in particular gaming engine technology, which was what was being taught in the art technology program, would allow you to do better geology.
It would allow me to visualize it much more effectively because,
and navigate through
and
it.
Navigate around it and through it.
And in fact, at the time, your supervisor was a professor called Carlos Aiken, who happens to have also developed a number of innovative software systems for geosciences, including the use of virtual reality caves for the use of geologists and training of geologists. But also, I think he had some tablet-based systems and so on.
Yep, yep. He did, where you could go into the field and you could interpret looking at the rocks on the tablet. And in real time, it would send your interpretations to a server we had running. And that could then be projected onto a screen at the same time. So you could have somebody in the field, students, set of students in the field looking at the rocks, set of students back in the laboratory that you're projecting interpretations from the field.
So, you know, from my point of view, you know, in a very natural kind of way, a transdisciplinary practice has developed here between geoscientists, computer scientists, and art and technology experts. And clearly, you know, there's a sweet spot there because the geoscientists feel that through these transdisciplinary practices, they can do better geology.
Yes, yes, they can, absolutely. I think it's important for geologists to visualize very complex problems effectively. And you mentioned earlier about bringing a bunch of people together into a laboratory setting to talk about some scientific problems. And the one example I can make is we talked about sequence stratigraphy and sea level rise and fall. Well, it's not as simple as a beach rising and falling. At the time, continents were moving around. So the orientation of the beach changes throughout this entire sea level rise and fall process. And so it would be very nice to have a bunch of visual artists, say, meet with a bunch of geologists, and we describe what this is happening, and they draw for us, or they create animations of this, and then we can then better visualize what the sea level rise and fall is doing to the rocks and relate that back to processes and, you know, over millennia.
Very good. The other thing that we were discussing at breakfast with Andrew Blanton, who unfortunately just had to go catch a train to back to Holland, where he's performing this evening, he's an artist, was the topic that we discussed yesterday at a party where we talked about intergenerational communication. And I'm 66 year old. How old are you?
I'm 31.
And Andrew was 35, I think. And so indeed, we're all at very different points in our careers. And one of the discussions that we've been having with Nina Zeglady has been how in our community of practice, the 70 and 8-year-olds are socially disconnected from the 20 to 30-year-olds. I mean, our universities are socially segregated by age. And so one of the topics that kind of came up was how would you enable intergenerational communication? Let's take the case of geology. And so, you know, are the people that you studied as a student, the texts that you've read, articles that you've read, that were maybe written in the 60s, and those people are still alive? Are there people that you would identify that you'd like to have a conversation with?
There are. One of the big people who talked about river processes and kind of what the landforms left behind from a river is a guy called Gary Nichols, who did a lot of work in Spain. And I met him at a conference in Dublin, in Ireland.
How old is he now?
I don't want to give it away. I think he's 50, 54, uh-huh. Maybe.
Okay.
But he was one of the monumental figures and he's world-renowned for writing textbooks to explain kind of landforms left behind from fluvial processes. So it was really, really neat to meet him because he helped me throughout my PhD.
Because of the text that he
Of the text and talking to him at the conference and other conferences I've met him at. I think it'd be also very important to meet, I haven't met them, it'd be like nice to meet kind of the pioneers of sequence stratigraphy as we've been talking about. Because it's a fairly...
Which was developed in the 70s
and 80s. 70s and 80s, right. Yeah. So the guys who developed it, they learned about it by figuring it out in the field and looking at the rocks. As opposed to me, when I went through undergraduate, I learned about it from a textbook that they had written. So it'd be really neat to talk to someone who they were around for the evolution of this concept and idea and to where it is now. And then myself, where I've just learned about it from a textbook.
And so your practice, in fact, has been shaped by those pioneers in sequence stratigraphy in that case. And it would be maybe interesting in a future podcast to see if we can engage in a discussion between you and people that are 30 years older
yeah,
than you.
Yeah, I think it'd be really neat to Because geology is a fairly new subject. It's only been around for a couple of hundred years or so.
Uh-huh.
In the sciences. So some of the pioneers are still around and alive, who were there before these big groundbreaking ideas of maybe sequence stratigraphy or global tectonics or something. So it'd be really neat to speak to them about these things that came to fruition throughout their careers, mid-career maybe, this shift in thinking. And when I started my career, those ideas were already in place. So I think it'd be a very interesting chat to have with them.
Okay, we've only got a couple of minutes left. What other ideas do we have at breakfast that you might want just like to mention that we could just close this podcast with?
We had talked a little bit about this interdisciplinary collaboration, mm-hmm. And we talked about not creating a department to have interdisciplinary yeah. collaboration. It should just be people in their respective fields get together and have a chat over coffee or maybe over a glass of wine or something. And we were talking about how best to bring these people into the same room, in inverted commas, at the same time. And we were talking about possibly virtual reality, maybe in the future could come together. But right now we have Skype, and I made a comment that I didn't particularly enjoy. I mean, I do enjoy Skype because it allows me to have a visual connection with somebody that I'm speaking to, but at the same time, I'm talking to a computer screen. It'd be nice to come up with some sort of way
right, and
to
so, get together. As you know, in animation, that's called the uncanny valley, which is if the animation is not quite lifelike, then immediately it isn't lifelike.
Right, yes.
And okay. And so indeed, in collaboration, the online systems that we have are just not lifelike enough compared to sitting together as we just did over breakfast for 2 hours.
Yeah.
Kicking around ideas, pursuing lines of argument together. And so indeed, clearly there's a real problem today, which is that the online systems that exist don't really support transdisciplinary collaboration in the way that we need to be able to explore ideas, translate ideas, and that tends to happen in informal settings, face-to-face, like in for breakfast in Paris.
Right, right. I think the best ideas come about scratching the back of a napkin in a pub or in a cafe having
yeah,
a coffee.
Yeah, we did not have alcohol for breakfast.
No, we didn't.
Okay, so
no.
Brian, I think we're going to have to, unfortunately, close this podcast.
Okay,
it's
very
been
good.
Great having breakfast with you in Paris. Let's do it again.
Likewise, absolutely. Thank you very much,
okay,
Roger.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
Yep.